6:30 p.m. in Room 100, Gregory Hall. Can journalism of social justice survive in the current media environment, and what direction might it take? For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu. Support for today's broadcast comes from the Prairie Ensemble, beginning their 10th concert season on Saturday, October 29th at 7:30 p.m. at McKinley Presbyterian Church in Champaign, featuring pianist Ian Hobson and trumpeter Amy Gilreath, and music by Haydn, Beethoven, and Shostakovich, plus an adaptation of Schubert's unfinished 10th Symphony. Information at 355-9077 or at prairieensemble.org.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we will look back to the 1930s, and we'll be talking about a boxing matchup that a lot of people would say is certainly one of the most important in the history of boxing, and some people would even say it's probably one of the most important in history, period. And that is the fight that took place in 1938 between Joe Louis and Max Schmeling. At the time, in the 1930s, Joe Louis arguably was the most famous black man in America. And certainly for black Americans, he was a great symbol of strength and pride. In Germany, Max Schmeling was also considered to be a hero. He was embraced by the Nazi regime and by Adolf Hitler. Well, a lot of people saw him as the embodiment of the German spirit and the ability of the German people to overcome adversity. Our guest this morning, David Margalek, says that when these two men met in the boxing ring, each of them came to symbolize much, much more than just himself. He's written about this in his recent book titled Beyond Glory, Joe Louis versus Max Schmeling and a World on the Brink. It's published by Knopf and is out now in the bookstore if you want to take a look at it. Our guest, David Margalek, is a longtime contributing editor at Vanity Fair, where he writes about culture, the media, and politics. He served as a national legal affairs editor at the New York Times, where he wrote the weekly column At the Bar for 7 years. He's also the author of a book entitled Strange Fruit, the biography of a song. The book we're talking about here this morning, Beyond Glory, is his fourth. He makes his home in New York City, and he's talking with us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions, comments are certainly welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. If it's a toll-free, or pardon me, if it's a long-distance call for you, here's where I'm getting at. We have a toll-free line. So if you're listening around Illinois and Indiana, and it would be long-distance call. In fact, if you're listening on the Internet, any place in the United States, you can use the toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Margalek, hello.
Hi, David.
Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I appreciate it. Nowadays, I think probably if you went around and asked people what they think about the sport of boxing, I think probably most people have a fairly low opinion of it. And there are even some people who might go as far as to say that as boxing is practiced at the professional level, maybe there even shouldn't be professional boxing. Maybe it should be banned. When you look back to the 30s, how did people think about boxing then?
Well, you know, I'm not a big boxing fan myself. I mean, I won't defend contemporary boxing, but I think that back in the 1930s, it was a less politically correct age in a sense, and people were, I guess, more used to brawny spectacles than they are now, and boxing was absolutely huge. I think it was really second only to baseball in popularity. Heavyweight championship boxing was really, you know, one of the most popular sports in the country and was an international sport. It was the international sport in a sense. It was popular all over the world. And a heavyweight championship fight, which are almost always held in the United States, were the single biggest event in all of sports. And the heavyweight champion of the world was really the biggest sports celebrity in the world.
Mm-hmm. And then the fights and the men, what they did in the ring and outside the ring, that would have made news everywhere.
It made news everywhere. People took a great personal identification in boxing because boxing appealed to many different constituencies, every different ethnic group, had its own representatives. There were black boxers, Jewish boxers, Italian boxers, Polish boxers, Irish boxers, white and black, from different nationalities, and in different cities, different neighborhoods would have their favorites. Boxing sort of was part of the fabric of every major American city, and there were clubs and there were boxing clubs all over the place. You have to remember that it was before television, and you know, people would like to go out at night, and there were in New York City on the average weeknight, there were 5 or 6 or 7 fights going on.
That's you mentioned that in the book, and that's really remarkable to think that not only would it have this level of popularity that somebody like Joe Louis would be an international celebrity, but that it would be such a common and popular form of entertainment to the point that, as you say, at least in a big city, someplace like New York, there was always a fight going on. If you wanted to go see a fight, there would be almost always an opportunity to do that.
Yeah, and there are all these different clubs that had them, and I'm sure it was the same thing in Chicago. I mean, when Louis was coming up, and Chicago is a very important part of the Joe Louis story, and when Louis was coming up, when he first went pro, you know, there are all these different places where he had his fights all over town that any old-time Chicago person would remember.
Yeah, I think, isn't it not true that he had his first professional fight in Chicago?
Yeah, he turned pro in Chicago.
Yeah.
He was from Detroit. I mean, he grew up in Detroit. He was born in Alabama, came to Detroit as a young boy, and then when he went professional, he went to Chicago. And as I say, Chicago is a very important part of the Louis story, because Louis, you know, one of the crucial questions about Louis was whether he, as a black man, was going to be given a shot at the heavyweight crown. And one of the things that he had going in his favor was the Chicago Tribune sponsored the Golden Gloves competition that Louis won as an amateur. And because of that, the Tribune was in Joe Louis's corner. And with the Tribune in your corner, it was a lot harder to be turned down.
How did he, Joe Louis, how did he get interested as a young man in boxing?
Well, he had been interested. He was sort of an athletic kind of guy, but there weren't a lot of opportunities in baseball or football or other sports. And boxing, you know, sort of made its way into his neighborhood in Detroit. His friends were all boxing, and he liked it more than playing the violin, which is what his mother wanted him to do. And, you know, one of his friends took him to a gym one day, and he put on some gloves, and it all flowed from there.
That's too much like a movie that his mom wanted him to play the violin.
You know, in fact, maybe, you know, I have no reason to think the story's not true, but you're absolutely right that it's the kind of thing out of a movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, Joe Louis's early life was often mythologized. Louis was an absolutely enormous cultural figure in this country. And you can imagine that when he came up and when he hit the big time, every newspaper reporter was writing a story about Louis's early life. And so the story about the violin became a staple of the Louis saga.
Mm-hmm. Schmeling was older than Joe Louis. He started boxing sooner. I think he started his professional career 10 years before Joe Louis did.
Yeah, he was 9 years older.
How did he get involved in boxing?
Well, that's another interesting story that I describe in the book. Boxing had been illegal in Germany before World War I, but the occupying Allied troops were big boxing fans, and so they sort of brought boxing to Germany after World War I. And a lot of the Germans were in POW camps during the war, and they brought boxing back with them. So there was a boxing craze in Germany in the 1920s, and Schmeling sort of caught that. And he became a boxer in the middle of all of that, and there was a kind of boxing frenzy in Germany. Everybody liked it. Everybody loved going to the fights. Intellectuals like Brecht and other people, you know, sort of described boxing in very artistic terms. It was a working-class sport. It was an intellectual sport. It was a sort of a sport of aesthetes and brawlers at the same time. It sort of ran the gamut in German society. And Schmeling caught that frenzy and prospered under it.
Yeah, the thing about Schmeling that people seem to fix on, that I think particularly a lot of people in Germany seem to fix on, was the fact that he He could be down, and yet he could, in both a literal and figurative sense, pick himself up and come back.
Well, Schmeling became sort of a metaphor for Germany, just as you described in the opening there. That Schmeling, you know, what's largely forgotten is that Schmeling had a long career in America before the two fights against Joe Louis. Schmeling was the champion. He won the championship on a foul in 1930 and was champion until 1932. And when he lost the championship to Jack Sharkey, he lost a couple more fights after that. He lost to Max Baer, and then he lost to a fellow named Steve Hamus. And everybody thought he was through. You know, he was in his 30s, and people thought that he didn't have much left. This was around the time that Hitler came to power, and my book is not principally about boxing. It's about sort of the cultural significance of these particular fights and how boxing fits into a much wider context of politics and civil rights. And that was certainly the case with Schmeling. Hitler loved boxing. Hitler thought that what made for good boxers made for good soldiers, and it was a way to toughen Germany up and sort of wipe out the last vestiges of Weimar, sort of Weimar weakness and effeminacy in a way. And so he was very much into boxing. He also, the Nazis craved international recognition and legitimacy, and to have a German as heavyweight champion, you know, a specimen of Aryan physical superiority and mental superiority, became a very big deal for the Nazis. So Schmeling goes back to Germany after he loses these fights in America, and once it's clear that he still has some stuff in him, and he begins a comeback, the Nazis gradually come to embrace him, and his fights become huge Nazi spectacles, and they very much support the idea, contrary to the prevailing myth, one of many myths I try to explode in this book, that they opposed his fights with Joe Louis. They didn't want him fighting a black man to whom he was going to lose, supposedly. In fact, they were very much behind these fights because they wanted Schmeling to be heavyweight champion of the world, and he would have to fight Joe Louis in order to do that.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is David Margalek. He's a longtime contributing editor at Vanity Fair magazine, and he's the author of a new book. It's titled Beyond Glory, Joe Louis versus Max Schmeling and a World on the Brink. It's published by Knopf, and as he explains, it is about this fight that took place between Louis and Schmeling in 1938, but much more, it's about what they and this fight meant to various kinds of people around the world. The book's out now in the bookstore if you want to look at it. Questions are welcome. We have somebody here who would like to get in on the conversation. Other people are welcome to do that. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. We have a caller in Indiana on our line 4 right here. Hello.
Hello, a couple of comments, perhaps a question. I was a youngster when Joe Louis was champion, and I remember all my buddies, I'm white, of course, all my buddies, we wanted to be like Joe Louis, and now that I'm much older and seen the world, I realized how, you know, in a sense it was almost phenomenal, I was from a small town in the Midwest, which certainly was racist in a lot of ways. But we all wanted to be like Joe Louis. I definitely remember that, and always was interested in seeing, you know, the newsreel when he would come on and show him knocking somebody out. We'd all yell and stuff like that. Second, I just recently purchased Spirit of Youth, which is sort of the autobiography of Louis, which he stars in, actually. And your comments about his mythologizing of his early childhood and stuff, I don't know, it may be like a movie, but it certainly could have been happened that way. And the next comment is sometime, I think it was in the 50s on TV, maybe later, I saw him on a TV show, and so they put the gloves on and they had somebody, take a couple of whacks at him, you know, close up. And I was just amazed. He just seemed to move his hands so slowly, but he stopped every blow, you know, just tap, 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 tap like that. And I wonder if you could make some comments about most of the boxers then were pretty much the same weight and almost height, too, and other measurements they make of boxers. He seemed to be incredibly fast. I was wondering if that's really was his one-upmanship on everybody. Thanks a lot.
All right.
Well, I appreciated those comments very much, and I just have a few observations to make about them. The first is I think it's that the caller from Indiana made a very profound point. Lewis was an unsung hero of the civil rights movement, to my mind, precisely for the reason that the gentleman suggests, that he was the first black man that whites cheered and wanted to emulate, you know, like the caller and his boyhood friends. I mean, there's a quote in the book from Roy Wilkins. He's reviewing when Lewis trained in Kenosha, Wisconsin in 1937 to fight Jimmy Braddock for the title. And Roy Wilkins went to the training camp, and he noticed that he either went to the training camp or he saw newsreels of the training camp, and he saw white kids emulating Joe Lewis. And he said, when white kids start naming themselves and emulating a Negro boy, something profound is going on. This had never happened before. And I think that Lewis educated a whole generation of whites in racial tolerance in a sense that hasn't been fully realized, and Lewis became sort of an unfashionable figure in recent years. He ended very badly, and we can talk about that. But I think that it's important to recognize the contribution that he made. The movie Spirit of Youth is not a great movie, and even in the black papers, Lewis was criticized. You know, people, the critics in the black papers said he should really stick to boxing. But it was an enormous event in the black community when the film opened up, I think in 1937 or 1938, and Lewis showed up at all the premieres in Washington and Philadelphia and New York, all the way up the Eastern Seaboard, and it was an enormous event. Damon Runyon, who was a boxing writer, once, I think, wrote a 13-part series analyzing Lewis's boxing style, and speed was one of the things. I mean, speed, posture, positioning, musculature. He sort of very minutely broke down Joe Lewis's various skills. Lewis was not big, as the caller said. You know, he weighed about 200 pounds at the time of the Schmeling fight, small by today's standards. But he was incredibly fast, and his hands were very fast. He wasn't a dancer in the Ali style, but he was incredibly quick. And there was... one famous fight that he had in 1935 where he was fighting somebody who'd never been knocked down before, and everybody was just waiting for this fellow who sort of fought in a crouch and was compared to a turtle because he always covered himself up and protected himself against blows. But sooner or later, he would lower his guard, and in that split second, Lewis would hit him, and sure enough, it happened, and the guy went down for the first time in his career, and people just couldn't believe how fast he was. But it was only one of his many skills.
Schmeling and Lewis fought twice. They fought in 38 when Lewis won. They also fought, though, in 36, and this was at a time when people thought that Joe Lewis was unbeatable and Max Schmeling was washed up, and Schmeling knocked him out.
Yeah, this is, you know, some people think they know the story of Lewis and Schmeling. But if they know the story at all, they only know the second half of the second fight and how it ended in 124 seconds. But you really can't understand the second fight unless you understand the first fight. And it was, you know, and you painted it in very broad brush strokes. And that's exactly what happened, David. Lewis was not yet the champion. It was 1936. Jimmy Braddock was still the champion. But everybody assumed that Lewis, were he given the shot, would win. Lewis was really the uncrowned champion, the champion in waiting. It was just a matter of time. And he was clearing away the underbrush, in a sense. He was beating all of these washed-up former champions just to win the credential to fight Jimmy Braddock. And Schmeling was seen as one more sacrificial lamb along the way. You know, it had been 4 years since he'd been champion. He was born in 1905, 31 years old by then, you know, and seen as over the hill. Lewis was the 10-1 favorite for the fight. It was absolutely inconceivable to people that Lewis would lose, and the writers sort of, you know, vied to come up with the proper metaphor to describe how absolutely certain it was that Lewis would win. You know, I mean, one I remember one story, the lead paragraph read, it was only two words, "What round?" The only question was how long it would take Lewis to knock out the guy. But they had underestimated Schmeling. Schmeling was a very methodical, disciplined boxer, and he had studied Lewis's technique, and he discovered that Lewis had a flaw in his technique, that he dropped his left after jabbing and therefore left himself open for a right. And if you were willing to take some punches in the face and get close enough, you could come back and hit Lewis, and that's what Schmeling did, and he sort of beat him down, and it took him 12 rounds, but he finally did knock Lewis out. And I think that one of my favorite sections in the book really is describing, well, I have many favorite sections, I guess every author does, but one of them is describing the kind of giddy, carefree feeling in Lewis's camp before the fight, a camp that was suffused with overconfidence. And then after the fight, the absolute devastation that descended upon African America after that fight. You have to realize that Lewis was really all they had going. I mean, it was the Depression, sports were segregated, society was segregated, and here was this mythical guy who'd come along and was sort of promising to make everything right, a man who was licensed, the only black man, as Malcolm X later put it, the only black man who was licensed to slug a white man and not be lynched for it, and not only not be lynched, but make tens of thousands of dollars and live extravagantly and live in the way that all of black America could live vicariously through him, and destined, seemingly ordained to be the heavyweight champion of the world, the first black champion since Jack Johnson. And then all of a sudden, the whole thing goes up in smoke, and he's knocked out, and a depression descended upon his community. There was one story that somebody told me that illustrates it beautifully, that somebody was on the south side of Chicago the day that Martin Luther King was shot, and more than one person told him that day that it was the saddest day in their lives since the day that Schmeling beat Lewis.
Yeah. We are at our midpoint here. I have another caller here we want to get to in just a second. I just want to introduce again our guest for anybody who might have tuned in the last little bit. We are talking with David Margulek. He is a longtime contributing editor at Vanity Fair, where he writes about culture, the media, and politics. He also served as national legal affairs editor at the New York Times, where for 7 years he wrote the weekly column At the Bar. He's the author of the book Beyond Glory, Joe Lewis versus Max Schmeling and A World on the Brink. It's brand new. It's published by Knopf, out now in the bookstores if you want to read it. Questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Next up, we'll talk with someone in Chicago. Line number 4. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Yes.
Listen, I was curious, when Lewis and Schmeling were going to fight that second fight, is it true that he saw that President Roosevelt had an interview with Joe Lewis and Max Schmeling, on the other hand, had an interview with Hitler? Did it get that big?
Well, you know, this is another one of those things that's sort of encrusted in myth. Lewis told the story that before the second fight, he met with Franklin Roosevelt, and Franklin Roosevelt felt his muscles and said, "We need muscles like yours to fight to beat Germany."
Supposedly that's what he said.
That's the story that's told. I don't believe it, and I could never find any documentation for it. Lewis first told that story many years afterward, and as far as I could tell, and this is a writer's compulsion, I suppose. I mean, I called the FDR library to try to document any meetings that they had. As far as I can tell, they met only once in 1935. So before even his first fight with Schmeling, and they had Lewis went to the White House and met with Roosevelt, and one of the black papers said the question is, what's newsworthy here, that Joe Lewis met with Franklin Roosevelt, or that Franklin Roosevelt met with Joe Lewis?
Yeah, now when
so there's no doubt that he met Roosevelt, as far as Roosevelt saying that, I have my doubts that he ever said that.
What about
Hitler?
I'm sorry. What about Hitler and Schmeling? Did they ever?
And then Hitler met with Schmeling many times.
Oh.
And, you know, Schmeling later got a lot of credit for being an anti-Nazi and for never joining the Nazi Party. The situation, as I write in the book, is much more complicated than that. The Nazis used Schmeling. Schmeling used the Nazis. Schmeling met with Hitler many, many times, including before he came over. Hitler asked him to vouch for Germany and and to tell Americans that everything was okay in Germany. Hitler asked Schmeling to intervene with the American Olympic Committee to assure Americans, considering a boycott of the Berlin Olympics in 1936, that the Berlin Olympics would be fair. Schmeling met with Hitler after he beat Joe Lewis and flew back to Germany on the Hindenburg to a tumultuous welcome. He met with Hitler and Goebbels the next day after he came back. He did not meet with Hitler, as far as I can remember, before the second fight. I don't think they actually met. But Hitler sent Schmeling a telegram the morning of the second fight, wishing him well and referring to him as the future world champion.
Well, after 36, I think he, although Hitler might have wanted to make things right, he couldn't bring himself to shake hands with Jesse Owens.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's right. And I'm often asked, it's interesting that you mentioned Jesse Owens, I'm often asked to compare Lewis and Owens, and there's a wonderful story where Lewis and Owens are in Washington together, and everybody's ignoring Owens and paying attention only to Lewis.
Now, just one
And I think that says a lot. Boxing was infinitely more popular than track and field, and Lewis was, you know, just exponentially more popular in Black America than Jesse Owens.
Well, they had that Friday night fight on every Friday night. You could listen to it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it was part of American culture.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
All right,
thank you.
Just to carry on a little bit with the issue of Schmeling and the Nazis, we were talking a little bit earlier about the fact that there was great symbolic significance, and that there were many Americans rooting for Joe Lewis, Black Americans, yes, but also white Americans and Jewish Americans, and it had a lot to do with the fact that for a lot of people, Schmeling represented Germany and the Nazis. And so this was who were you going to root for? You're certainly not going to root for the Nazis.
Well, that's right. That's right. I think that, I mean, there were clearly some white Americans who rooted for Schmeling. You know, I mean, Jimmy Carter tells the story in his memoirs of listening to the fight on the peanut farm in Plains, Georgia, you know, and all the Black field hands came in to listen to the radio on Jimmy Carter's family's porch. And he writes that his father was pulling for Schmeling. And I think, you know, they're clearly, you know, not every American was pulling for Lewis because he was American. But what was striking was that so many Americans were. And there were reporters who sort of did surveys in the South. There was one Southern-born reporter who wrote for the New York Daily News, and he went home and sort of surveyed people, and he said that 3 out of 4 whites down there were pulling for Lewis. I mean, this is absolutely an extraordinary thing to me. You know, in the 1930s, for whites to be pulling for a Black man to win,
yeah.
And partly it was a function of Schmeling's unpopularity. After all, he represented Nazi Germany, and he represented a country with which America had been at war, you know, a decade and a half earlier. But also it was because of Lewis. Lewis was a very engaging, likable guy. You know, Lewis and his managers from Chicago, one of them was from Chicago, had specifically ordained, really, that Lewis was not to be like Jack Johnson, the previous Black champion who had scandalized much of white and Black America with his conduct, marrying, carrying on with white women and all of this. And Lewis was very different than that. He was self-effacing, he was shy, and he was the kind of person who went down very easily in white America.
Well, that's interesting. Here, that's another interesting feature of Joe Lewis and of this story, and that is the inevitable comparisons between Lewis and Jack Johnson. Johnson was the world's first Black heavyweight champion, and as you say, was very flamboyant, was very controversial. I'm sure to a lot of Black Americans, he was a hero, but to white America, I think a lot of the scholarships you see now argues that he was seen in at least a symbolic way as a threat. He was so much in the face of white America, and you know, no doubt there would be some Black Americans maybe would have said, maybe this is not the guy that we would want to be representing.
Yeah, he was controversial even in Black America. And, you know, after Jack Johnson lost the title in 1915, the boxing powers that be vowed that there would never be another Black champion. They weren't going to let it happen again. But when Lewis came along, they couldn't stop him. They couldn't stop him because, as I said, he had a lot of whites behind him. He had the Chicago Tribune behind him. But it was also that Lewis was too darned exciting. You know, boxing was in trouble. Jack Dempsey had retired. Gene Tunney had retired. And all of a sudden, this incredibly exciting guy was reviving an entire sport. And there was a lot of money to be made off of him, and everybody wanted to see him. Damon Runyon said, people love a puncher. It doesn't matter whether they're white or black or green or yellow. And so when Lewis came along, he just became really a sort of irresistible force. Now, one of Lewis's greatest critics was Jack Johnson. And when everybody else was singing Lewis's praises, Jack Johnson was criticizing him. And a lot of people thought it was because Jack Johnson was jealous. And, one measure of Lewis's popularity was how unpopular Jack Johnson became for criticizing Lewis. I should also mention, just in another local angle, is that one of Lewis's greatest champions was the Chicago Defender, the black paper in Chicago, which wrote, like every black paper, wrote minutely about everything that Lewis did. Lewis's private life, Lewis's purchasing, Lewis's clothing, Lewis's where Lewis lived, his social life. Lewis married a Chicago girl, and the Defender recorded all of that. The Defender had a poll of its readers to say, who was the greater fighter, Jack Johnson or Joe Lewis? And 40,000 people participated in this poll. I mean, it just gives you some kind of an idea of how important Lewis and boxing was in that culture at that time.
Yeah. Just for to go back for a moment to Schmeling and the Nazis, it seems that this is a sort of a fuzzy, or at least maybe before you wrote this book, that the picture seemed kind of fuzzy to me, at least because you find people saying so many different things, either saying that he was a Nazi. Certainly a lot of boxing fans thought he was. A lot of other people said, well, no, that's really not true, that he in fact was anti-Nazi. And you talked about the fact that he used them and they used him. Just how did he have any kind of odd ideological commitment to the Nazi agenda?
Well, I think that it's fuzzy in part because it was fuzzy at the time. I mean, Schmeling became subject to different stereotypes. He was portrayed as a Nazi at the time of these fights, and he was never a member of the party. He was really a pretty apolitical guy. But he was also an opportunist. He was willing to go along with the flow. And if the Nazis were going to help him, he was quite willing to accept their help. And so, I think people are also misled because Schmeling got to write pretty much his own history. I mean, my feeling is that he got kind of a free pass from history after the war. He wrote his autobiography, and, he represents himself in his autobiography as a great anti-Nazi. That became the accepted wisdom. I don't think it's true. And one of the things that, I read very extensively in the American papers, in the German papers, and it was, it's very clear to me that he was far more in bed with the Nazis. Even though he was an apolitical guy, he was far more in bed with the Nazis than he ever fessed up to.
You talked a little earlier about the fact that what you were interested in writing was not so much a boxing book and probably not so much about the fights specifically, but about what they meant and about the atmosphere surrounding them. Having said all that, I do want to have you talk at least a little bit about the 38 fight. I guess, as you say, one thing that everybody remembers is that Joe Lewis knocked out Max Schmeling in the first round. So it was a short fight.
It flabbergasted everyone. I mean, the thing is, as I said, I'm not a huge boxing fan, but there's something mesmerizing about a good boxing match, particularly a good historical match where there's more at stake than just one guy against another. And I think, this fight was probably one of the most anticipated fights ever. Particularly after Lewis won the championship in 1937, he said, I'll never be the real champion until I beat Schmeling. He realized that. So this was the fight that everybody wanted to see. By my calculation, there were 100 million people at least listening to their radios that night. I think the largest radio audience in the history of mankind up to that point. Lewis, normally these fights would start out slowly. People would sort of feel one another out for a couple of rounds. But Lewis was very angry that night. Lewis thought that Schmeling was a bad sport. He thought that Schmeling had accused him unfairly of fouling him deliberately in the first fight, when Schmeling, in fact, had thrown a foul punch himself. Lewis also felt that Schmeling had made some racist comments, you know, sort of suggesting that a black man could never get over a beating and that blacks were psychologically different from whites. And so Lewis was very angry that night, and he predicted that he would win in two rounds. No one really believed it because Lewis usually wasn't that fast a starter, and Schmeling was very methodical and slow himself. It took him 12 rounds to knock out Lewis in the first fight. So Lewis just came out like a wild machine that night, and very quickly had Schmeling on the ropes, punched him, broke a couple of his vertebrae, punched him in the side, and the whole thing was over before, you know, people were still sitting down, were still taking off their coats, were still sort of unburdening themselves and settling in, and the fight was over. You know, there's a wonderful story about Count Basie dropping his hat and bending over and picking it up, and it was over by the time he came up. And, you know, the call of the fight, you know, anybody who was around back then remembers it, the famous Clem McCarthy call of the fight. And Schmeling is down, the count is 5-6. It's one of the immortal moments in all of radio. What they don't remember as well, but they remember in Germany, is the Nazi announcer who also just went crazy. He couldn't believe that his man, that Schmeling couldn't lose. Schmeling was smarter. He had more character. He was more disciplined. He was the embodiment of the new Germany. And he couldn't lose. And all of a sudden, he was losing before this fellow's eyes. And he just basically lost it on the air. No one in Germany could understand what was going on.
We have about 10-12 minutes left in this part of Focus. Again, I'd just like to introduce the guest. We're talking with David Margalek. He's a longtime contributing editor at Vanity Fair, and he is the author of a number of books. His most recent is Beyond Glory, Joe Lewis versus Max Schmeling and A World on the Brink, which takes a look at their fights, particularly the one that we were just talking about here that happened in 1938, but also the atmosphere surrounding them and how these two men, as I said at the beginning of the program, came to represent so much more than just themselves. The book is out now. It's published by Knopf. And if you have questions, comments, give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think another...
To add something, David,
yes,
to that story that I was telling,
yes,
the German announcer says, Maxie, get up. You know, he's not describing what's going on. He's pleading with his hero to get up.
Yeah.
Of course, he couldn't get up.
The finish of the story, going beyond this match and going into the later life of the men, is a very interesting story, both for the kind of reversal of fortune that the two men experienced, at least in the sense that one went on to success outside the ring and the other really didn't. And then another part of that is the relationship between the two men that came about in later life.
Right. Well, I write in brief about all of this in my epilogue. I mean, my book basically ends with the end of the second fight, but I do trace the broad outlines of what happened, and it's sort of a cruel twist of fate, really. Schmeling goes into the Wehrmacht, the German soldier during the war. Lewis goes into the American Army. When the war is over, Lewis's trajectory is all pretty much downward. I mean, he's over the hill. He's still a great boxer, but gradually his skills fade. And by the early 50s, he's through as a boxer, the rest of his life is sort of all down. I mean, he has drug problems, he has mental problems, he has terrible financial problems because he donated a couple of his purses to Army and Navy relief during the war and neglected to pay taxes on his winnings, even though he donated them. And he has the IRS hounding him. And, he has a series of degrading positions, ending up with serving as a greeter in Las Vegas, and dies in 1981. Schmeling, on the other hand, showing the same adaptability that he showed before, going from German democracy from Weimar Germany to Nazi Germany, becomes sort of an anti-Nazi hero. He manages to write his own history, as I say, and sort of carves out a role for himself as an anti-Nazi, somebody who had a Jewish manager. That's a whole other story. He gets a lot of mileage out of having had a Jewish manager when, in fact, because the boxing business was so heavily Jewish in New York. You needed a German needed a Jewish manager. It was really a matter of economic survival for Schmeling to have a Jewish manager, and he didn't treat him very well. And that's I write about that at great length in the book. But Schmeling gets the Coca-Cola franchise in Hamburg after the war, and becomes a multimillionaire. Coca-Cola, which would never ask Joe Louis to endorse anything, makes Schmeling a multimillionaire. And Schmeling dies last February at the age of 99, a very wealthy, prosperous, and respected man. And I think there's a lot of sadness in the respective fates of these two guys.
Yeah.
Now, as far as their relationship is concerned, as I say, Louis did not like Schmeling and made no effort at a reconciliation. They didn't see one another for 16 years after their second fight. In 1954, Louis is living in Chicago. Schmeling comes to Chicago and seeks Louis out. And from that moment on, they see one another periodically. I think that the extent and depth of their relationship has been exaggerated. I don't think that they were great buddies, but there's no doubt that they got together from time to time, you know, at various boxing-related events. And the story that Schmeling paid for Louis's funeral. I also doubt this. I'm told by Truman Gibson, Joe Louis's lawyer, living in his 90s in Chicago still, that it never happened. And I think that Truman Gibson is a more reliable source on this than anybody else. Mm.
What about the story that also Schmeling paid some of Louis's medical bills when he was in...
There's no way of verifying that. Louis was, you know, in Louis's last years, he was basically taken care of by Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas. And I think that I find it unlikely it's not impossible that Schmeling gave Louis money, but I doubt very much that he was paying medical bills.
Mm. Let's talk with another caller in Chicago, line one. Hello.
Hello. I was going to ask about Schmeling's relationship to Louis in their later years, and you already answered that. But maybe you could comment on the fact that when Louis went into the Army, he declined any kind of officer role and went in as a private. I'll get off the phone and let you comment.
Okay.
You know, I don't know much about that, actually, because, as I say, it's sort of beyond the scope of my story. But I do know that, you know, Louis further endeared himself to the American public by his military service. You know, Jimmy Walker, the former mayor of New York, said he laid a rose on Abraham Lincoln's grave, a famous quote. Another famous quote, Louis said, you know, we're going to win because we're on God's side in the war. And Louis, you know, visited the troops, refused to participate in events in segregated settings, and I think only enhanced his already enormous popularity through what he did during the war.
Yeah, and what I have read about this, it makes it sound, I don't mean to denigrate Joe Louis, but it makes it sound that as far as the Army was concerned, that his role was kind of a public relations, goodwill ambassador, whereas, this may not be true, that the Nazis in the Third Reich were so upset with Schmeling for having lost that they put him into combat and they were hoping that he would get killed.
Yeah, I don't think that's true, David. I think that Schmeling later said that he was drafted punitively, but, you know, from all that I can see, Schmeling was an enthusiastic soldier. He appeared on the cover of the German Paratroopers magazine. He told one interviewer he had hoped that Germany would win the war. I simply don't think that that's true.
So you think this is maybe more of this business of his trying to rewrite his story a little bit.
I think that's really mythology. I think that from all that I could see from reading the German papers, Schmeling did not go back to Germany in disgrace. Okay, that's another myth.
Mm-hmm.
Schmeling continued to appear in the Nazi press. He was still held up in the magazine of the Hitler Youth as a role model for German boys. He went to the Nuremberg rally, the annual party rally in Nuremberg, the year after the fight. These were not gestures that could have been made by somebody who was in disgrace.
Going back just to the holding with this sort of overall idea of this as being a a significant event, not just in the history of boxing, but in the history of the world, the 38 fight, how this all comes together, how this fight and these men came to represent so much. Why is this something that that deserves a chapter, at least in the history of the 20th century, say?
Well, I think that, you know, when I say in the book that the subtitle of my book is A World on the Brink, and I think the world was on the brink of two things. It was on the brink of a civil rights revolution that Lewis embodied, and I think, you know, all of the civil, everything that Joe Lewis represented in his own community and to the white community makes this story far transcend sports. And then the rivalry between the U.S. and Germany and the symbolic significance of Lewis standing up to somebody who was seen as an emissary of Hitler, to the point where, you know, the Jews all over the world were listening to this and pulling for Lewis. It just sort of crystallizes the state of the world on the edge of the abyss. Hmm. It's all of the issues that were to explode only a year or two later were simmering in connection with this fight. They were all sort of underlying this fight. This fight came to embody everything the world became in the next few years.
Yeah, and when this fight took place here in the United States, probably other places, life pretty much came to a stop.
I think that, you know, I mean, we're in an era of 500 television stations and the internet and a million things to do. This was what America did that night. The world stopped that night. Nothing else, you know, nothing else mattered. I mean, there were 20 or 30 million Germans who stayed up all night to listen to this fight, and 60 million Americans. That was half of the American population listened to the fight. And you know, if you read the papers in for instance, I read the papers in Warsaw, and there was a poem that was written by a Jew in one of the Jewish papers in Warsaw, describing how much Lewis's victory meant to the Jews of Warsaw. Just absolutely extraordinary. Mm.
Let's talk with someone else here in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello. Well, I haven't read your book, so I don't want to be, too quick to criticize you, but I have heard you on another show. I think mm-hmm. that you've inflated the value of this with this euphoric nostalgia mm-hmm. for a past that wasn't even, in fact, it wasn't even at all great at the time it was happening. And I would make a quick analogy that, our entire folklore has been rewritten by the popular culture or actually suppressed by the popular culture in this country by creating superheroes like Paul Bunyan. And I would liken the kind of, images that the heavyweight and other boxers present to the kind of folk heroes. And yes, we do need folk heroes, but it's also very male, symbolic of a world that was very male-dominated and vulgar and violent and aggressive. And, as I say, I don't blame historians for wanting to dig up this sort of thing, but I'm going to write you a letter because I want to read your book first. I just think it's part of the false consciousness of the entire world, and certainly of the United States, and that it was, seized upon by the public relations industry, by the media, to keep it on the front pages to reassure the masses that they counted, you know, when actually it's far from being the intellectual. Bridge or many card games are intellectual compared to boxing. It's vulgar, and it's really brainless. So,
go ahead you can respond, Mr. Margulis.
No, you may, I hear what you say. You may disapprove of the importance that was placed on all of this, but there's no denying that it was viewed as terribly important. And if you look at, I'm not making this stuff up. You know, I read the papers very widely from that era. And, for instance, if you're talking about Joe Lewis, you read the characterizations of Joe Louis in the black press, and you might think the black press was manipulating the black masses. You're entitled to believe that. But I take it at face value. This is how they felt. This is how they saw it. And this is what I'm describing. And I might add, since you use some of the language of mass culture and sort of manipulation of mass culture, that one of the papers that covered Joe Louis the most aggressively was the Daily Worker. Okay, the communist paper started a sports section largely to cover Joe Louis because they thought of Joe Louis as an enormously important cultural figure. And I hope you look at the book. I appreciate your comment, and I'll look forward to hearing from you.
All right. Well, we must leave it there. The book is Beyond Glory, Joe Louis versus Max Schmeling in a World on the Brink. It's published by Knopf by our guest, David Margalek. He's a longtime contributing editor at Vanity Fair. Mr. Margalek, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, David.
Focus 580, our program, is made possible in part with support from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. The program today is also made possible by Parkland College Theater, presenting Bat Boy the Musical, a pop rock musical that tells the story of a half-boy, half-bat, trying to find love and acceptance in a world that shuns him. Performances run from Wednesday, October 26th, that's today, through Saturday, November 12th. More information is available at 351-2528. Coming up in the next part of Focus 580, we will be trying to get an update on what has been going on recently, certainly over the past couple of years, in the continuing crisis in Sudan, in the western region of Darfur. The United Nations has described the crisis there as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. We'll be talking a little bit about what this conflict is all about and about international efforts to end the fighting. Our guest for the show will be Dr. Ali Dinar. He is the outreach director of the African Studies Program at the University of Pennsylvania. So that'll be up in the next part of the show. We're going to take a break, as we usually do, for news and an update on the market, so stay tuned.
The Carle Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carle Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. Quiet exports and ongoing reports of big yields in the U.S. corn harvest pressed corn today to new contract lows once again. Commercial buying underpinning prices, along with occasional short covering bounces amid oversold tech.